Good evening and welcome, everybody. It is a pleasure for me to introduce Dr. Mario Trabone, a long-standing friend of mine, with whom I have cooperated on various occasions. Mario is an ophthalmologist by profession, but he is a very learned person. He is constantly reading and researching, and he's one of those few people I know that actually has a personal library running into thousands of books. And you can discuss with Mario any subject you like, because he always has an opinion, he's always researched the subject, and if you refer to a book, most probably he would have read it. So I think that it is a great privilege for us to hear him. Mario has cooperated with me in the past. I remember when I was chairman of Bank of Valletta Group, I used to organize on a yearly basis a conference in Gozo. And I used to make it a point that Mario chairs that conference for me, because I couldn't find a better person than him to conduct the proceedings and to be able to intervene in a learned and wise fashion. So, Mario, it's our pleasure to hear you. We will be listening to Mario for about 40 minutes, then we open the floor for any questions and discussion, and then we conclude. Thank you, Mario. Thank you.
Well, first of all, thank you, John. Thank you, Father Hilary, for inviting me. The first time I came to this hall, or rather to this place, I inquired, where is the WOW hall? But today, when I came in and I reflected on my subject, God, science, and the meaning of life, I said, wow, what a subject. however, it is an important subject, because when you consider it, it impacts on how we feel ourselves as persons, and probably also on the order of society and the world. So the subject basically, has science killed God? Is religion and science incompatible? Is it a clash to the death? And therefore, is meaning, is life meaningless? Now, I must say that these questions have troubled me, not to say haunted me, for many a decade. And I have to confess to you that what follows is, in a very real sense, a personal journey. But let me start with a story, because all beginnings start with stories. It is said that there were two goldfish. They were rather intellectual goldfish. One of them, when they were swimming lazily in a glass bowl, one of them said to the other, "This is the world we live in, and all there is to it." And she turned to the other one and said, "Don't you agree?" And the other one, after reflecting, said, "No." So goldfish number one snapped back and said, "Why do you say that?" And the quiet reply came, "Who changes the water?" So looking back, this goldfish may be a distant relative of mine, but, or maybe I conjured it up in my own image. Indeed, who changes the water, basically? So, as you know, many scientists would have us believe that the universe is a closed system. What you see is what you get. Don't look beyond. Unfortunately, that's what I'm going to do tonight. I'll try and look beyond. Allow me, though, to kick off with three short quotes which are relevant to our subject. The first one is from Psalm 19:1. "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork." This is, in fact, the kind of awe which we find in Jeremy Manley Hopkins, the Jesuit poet who wrote, "The world is charged with the grandeur of God." The second is from Job 11:7, which I have studied quite a bit. And he asks, "Can you, by searching, find out God?" Now, the way I see it, the implication here is no, as God's ways are mysterious. The third one is from Montaigne's Essays, Book 2, and is very relevant to our subject. Has God obliged himself not to exceed the bounds of our knowledge? Incidentally, you'll find this question, which is very interesting, almost identical question in Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century. Now, these quotes can be summed up in three simple questions. One, does the spectacle and workings of nature suggest a creator? Two, is the use of reason, including science, adequate to answer that question? Or the third, is faith irrational? Now, before attempting to answer these questions, I invite you to follow me on this excursion. But finally, I'll come back to them. I assure you I won't forget. As you know, in the last few decades, a strident campaign has been going on internationally by prominent scientists, philosophers, and public intellectuals on behalf of atheism and naked materialism. Belief has been pilloried as wishful thinking, religious teaching as a fairy tale, fit only for primitive societies and the ignorant. For example, anyone who doesn't accept blind evolution, now mind you, blind evolution, not evolution, is described by the two evangelists, I call them, of modern atheisms, as ignorant, inexcusably ignorant, by Daniel Dennett in his top-rating book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, and as ignorant, stupid, and insane by the famous Richard Dawkins, whom I'm sure many of you have heard. In fact, Dawkins goes further and refers to faith as one of the world's great evils, comparing it with AIDS and smallpox. So science has set the agenda and the stage. It has equated knowledge with scientific knowledge and bracketed out all other forms. Bertrand Russell put it this way: whatever knowledge is attainable must be attained by scientific methods, and what science cannot discover, mankind cannot know. To round off the atheist picture, the late Carl Sagan, you probably have seen, which I have, it was a fantastic TV series called Cosmos. And there he states, the cosmos is all there is, or was, or ever shall be. It reminds you of the goldfish here. Now, Peter Atkins, a well-known chemist and science writer, says that he sees no reason why science cannot discover everything, and hence science and religion cannot be reconciled. Now, we have to admit that science has been feted as the great liberator from superstition, and scientific knowledge celebrated as the only reliable form of knowledge. Science has been cracking one problem after another, has changed our way of living, and extended knowledge of the universe in a really breathtaking fashion. The march of science has been truly spectacular, with new discoveries practically every day, with men on the moon, and the vehicle now probing Mars, with astounding medical breakthroughs, the discovery of DNA, the Human Genome Project, the incredible complexity and capacity of communications technology, access to the fundamental particles of matter, and it's worth remembering, scientists are now exploring mind-boggling ranges from the very, very small, just imagine, like 1 over 10 to the power of 17 of a centimeter, and to the gigantic, like 10 to the power of 30. By the way, when you talk about science, you have to talk about some of these figures, but don't be put off. But just to suggest to you the enormity, the size of these numbers, if you take a chessboard, you know, with 64 squares, you put 1 grain of wheat on the first one, 2, 4, 16, etc., at the end, you'll end up with the total Welsh production of wheat for 20 years. So when we talk of numbers in science, one can have an idea of the enormity of these numbers, both on the large and on the small scale. Now, no doubt science has been one of the grandest intellectual sagas of mankind, and never before in the 200,000 years of man's history on this planet has so much been known about the world, the cosmos, and man himself. And the search to understand, explain, and find out continues. So let's be clear about the triumphalist agenda of science, as proposed by the so-called New Atheists, people like Dawkins, the late Hitchens, Dennett, Atkins, there are quite a few. And it is to reduce everything from the universe to man to the operation of blind, accidental particles, forces and energy, and nothing else. The miracle of life is dismissed by Dennett as an impersonal, unreflective, robotic, mindless scrap of molecular machinery, is the ultimate basis of all the agency and hence meaning and hence consciousness in the universe. Look how radical the agenda is. In fact, there is the story that when Napoleon encountered the famous Laplace, who is usually called the French Newton, he published a very important book called Celestial Mechanics. And when Napoleon heard the description by Laplace himself, he told him, "Where is God in all this?" And it is said that Laplace turned on him and told him, "Sire, we have no need of that hypothesis." And this brings us to the heart of our subject tonight. Do we need that hypothesis? Before we go on, I would like to sound a caution, which I learned myself from bitter personal experience. Not every statement by a scientist is a statement of science, and that many scientists are in fact very poor philosophers. In fact, Einstein himself averred that the man of science is a poor philosopher. The credibility of science among scientists and the general public is so high that I could make the following statement without probably being challenged. Science is certain, able to understand everything, and capable of a final unraveling of the enigma of man and the cosmos. If science could do that with Laplace, I say we don't need that hypothesis. Now, notice, this is not a statement of science, but a pious faith in science that you actually believe that it can do that. And we'll come across, incidentally, other examples of blind faith in the practice of science. And one of the things which I will suggest tonight is that both faith and the concept of mystery is not only found in religion, but also in science. For such a faith, however, to be reasonable, science would need to have no limits. So, are there limits to science? Please understand that by limits here is not meant the current capability of technology or state of our knowledge. If we wanted, for example, to send a probe to the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, at 39 million million kilometers away, probably it's not possible at the moment. However, there is nothing in the laws of physics to forbid such a venture eventually. So by limits I mean, are there intrinsic limits to science, impossibilities, so to speak? Because if there are limits, and it is suggested here eventually that there are, science cannot answer all the questions of man. Now, allow me to draw your attention to how science works. not to bother you, but it defines its character, goals, and also boundaries. There are basically six tools in science. There is one. The first is obvious, observation. If you see a thing or a phenomenon, you study it, examine it, describe it, either by the organs of sense or, of course, by instruments. The second one is called induction. If you notice a phenomenon repeatedly, then you draw a conclusion. For example, if you say, if I heat copper, it expands. If I heat a metal, it expands. If you keep heating metals, they always expand. So the conclusion is that metals on heating expand. The other one is called deduction. I'll soon be over with these, but it's important to keep them in mind. This is a process of logic, that if the premises are correct and you deduce what follows is correct if the premises are correct. It's the method of mathematics. However, remember, I mentioned this because the star method of science is mathematics. The fourth method is theory making. You know, a scientist, either incidentally by intuition or imagination, makes a theory for the explanation of a subject. And incidentally, the great advances of modern physics have been carried out mostly by theoreticians, not people who do experiments, including Einstein himself. Now, for example, last July, we heard about the discovery at CERN of the Higgs boson. That was predicted decades before by Higgs himself. And Dirac, who was an exceptional person, discovered antimatter, the positron, which today we use in the PET machine, years and years before it was actually found. However, theories are fine, so long as they are eventually tested by experiment. And of course, what I was mentioning before, the star method of mathematics, of science's mathematics. The reason that mathematics looks like the queen bee of science is that theory depends on mathematics. Also, mathematics is supreme in rigor, exactness, extraordinary in range and depth, and considered as the benchmark of certainty. It was also, until the first years of the 20th century, deemed flawless. But more of this later. And the sixth tool of science, and I'll be over with this, is of course experiment. However beautiful a theory is, it could be as beautiful and elegant as an orchid, if it is not proved by experiment, it is shot down. Now the reason why I text your patients with the main tools of science is to make it very clear. One, that science deals with the physical and cannot go beyond. In short, there is an edge to science, a limit. Also, and this is crucial, none of these tools, contrary to what many people think, none of these tools which I mentioned are absolutely faultless. Frankly, I could analyze each one of them, but it would take too long. But let me give you a simple example. It is true that when metals are heated, they expand. However, to be absolutely sure that one day you will not come across a metal which doesn't expand, you could go on heating metals till kingdom come. So even this obviously correct way of induction, you repeat one after one after one, it's still not based on completely empirical evidence, because one day it may not hold. So induction, once again, is which looks so obviously correct, is still based on fate. Now, the reason why I was so, I took some time on the limits of science, because on it depends everything we have to say on the relation between science and beyond. Now, I'll give you a few examples why there are limits to science. Science deals, as I said before, with the physical universe. As mentioned earlier, by its very nature and methods, it cannot confirm or deny another order of existence, like, for example, the spiritual dimension. Now, this is my favorite. The profound question agonizing to men, but ignored or marginalized by science, is why is there something and not nothing? One of the deepest philosophers of the 20th century, Ludwig Wittgenstein, put it, this way, in his quirky English, because he was Austrian. Not how the world is, but that it is, that is mystical. Now, there is a very important philosopher theologian called Keith Ward, who made a rather, he's a Brit, member of, fellow of the British Academy. Now, this guy is quite cutting edge. And he once made a comment, which I liked. He said, it is distinctly odd to think that there is a reason for everything, except for the most important item of all, that is the existence of everything. So science cannot answer that question, why is there something and not nothing? One other reason for the limits of science, as you know, the observable universe, by definition, observable, is thought to be 100 billion light years across. That is, light traveling at 300,000 kilometers a second takes 10 billion years to come here. Now, what is interesting about that is that beyond that, no information can get gathered, because the source of light is receding faster than the time it would take to come back to us. And so science cannot, by definition, explore the whole universe. Also, a time was when the universe was considered as eternal and infinite, you know. And so science, but now there is general consensus that the universe began in a gigantic explosion, you know, the famous Big Bang, 13.7 billion years ago. Incidentally, it was a Catholic Belgian priest astronomer, Georges Lemaître, who, using Einstein's equations and the expanding universe, who pointed out this singular event. This was exciting news for science, but also a source of some embarrassment. If the universe boomed into existence at a singularity, before there was nothing, and now there was something, what caused it? What was there before? The universe created itself, some have said, including a number of great scientists, but how can the universe create itself if it's not there in the first place? You remember when I warned you to be wary when scientists try to philosophize. No less a figure than Stephen Hawking, in his book The Grand Design, perhaps in a desperate effort to eliminate the need for a creator, comes out with this, to me, howler, where he says, because there is a law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself out of nothing. Now, frankly, to me, this is a silly statement. If there is a law and an agency that is not nothing, so it's not from nothing, the bottom line is that science cannot answer what Hawking himself, in another book, queried, why the universe goes to the bother of existing. Now, when I highlighted the tools of science, I referred to mathematics and promised to come back to it. I won't go into great detail, but as I said, the mathematics has been considered as the citadel of impeccable logic. In fact, around 1900, David Hilbert, who was the greatest mathematician of the time, challenged mathematicians to come up with a recipe by which the truth of any statement could be tested. Now, not too far from the time of Hilbert, in 1930, Kurt Gödel, indubitably the greatest logician of the 20th century, exploded a bombshell, and he published what are called theorems of incompleteness, where he found that, in fact, mathematics has a limit also. It cannot explain its own axioms, and it cannot explain the logic, how it goes. It doesn't mean that it is not a logical system, but it has limits. Even an elementary system of logic like arithmetic is constrained. It has limits. In fact, this is really extremely impressive. In fact, John Barrow, who is a very renowned physicist, put it this way: science is based on mathematics. Mathematics cannot discover all truths, therefore science cannot discover all truths, which is really quite a remarkable statement. One final example, and then we'll push on. Nowadays, there is a theory called the inflationary theory, which proposes that very early on, after the Big Bang, the universe surged enormously in size. There are various reasons why this theory is accepted. However, at the unimaginably early moment of 1 over 10 to the power of 30 of a second, the universe boomed. It enlarged itself enormously. Now, what this means is that beyond that limit, since there was this tremendous inflation, all information has been wiped out. So, whereas we mentioned earlier on that in the far distance and future there is a limit to science, in the past and the very earliest times there is no information. So, science has a limit in the future and in the past. In fact, when I think of this limitation, I always think of that verse in Revelation: I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last. The first and the last are intrinsically not available to scientific exploration. Now, I spend some time on the limits of science because the general public is not informed of the subject. In fact, the contrary applies. The impression is given that science can tackle and solve any query, and that there is nothing beyond science. In this respect, you know, there is a Nobel laureate called Peter Medawar, himself a humanist, by the way, not a believer. But he once wrote advice to a young scientist, and he told him, there is no quicker way to bring discredit on himself and his profession than roundly to declare that science knows, or soon will know, the answer to all questions. The reason why I've gone over some of these questions is to show that science has limits which are intrinsic and not temporary. They do not depend on technology or state of our knowledge. Now, I would like you to consider a common fallacy, by the way, committed by sometimes great scientists, especially the apostles, of course, of modern atheism. It concerns the nature of a scientific explanation. As you know, the holy grail of the most creative and adventurous scientists is the hunt for the final theory, you know, sometimes called GUT, Grand Unified Theory, or TOE, not TOE, theories of everything. In fact, a very noted scientist called Leo Lederman at the National Accelerator Laboratory in Chicago put it this way: we hope to explain the entire universe in a simple, single formula that you can print on your T-shirt. Now, that's it for him. Well, not exactly. A formula is a description. It's not a cause. It does not produce or create anything. Perhaps a simple example in my own field, if I may, will clarify the point. If a totally blind person from advanced cataracts comes to my office and I have a perfect description of a cataract operation in my desk drawer and do nothing and leave the description there, the patient will remain blind because the description does not produce or create anything, whereas sometimes scientists give you the impression that if they find the formula, that's it, it's the explanation. But it does not create. The formula comes because something already exists. So the direction of what is called nowadays scientism, to explain everything by science, is that the universe is the result of the operation of blind accidental forces with no design or purpose. Once again, this is not a statement of science, by the way, but a blind faith in science. But the fact remains that all the scientific endeavors and prodigious efforts to understand presume that there is some order in the universe. Otherwise, if we assume that the universe is haphazard, chaotic, random, deranged even, what happens to a physical law? After all, what is a physical law? It is an acknowledgement of some sort of order. As you know, there's been a raging controversy about whether there is or not design in nature. Dawkins, who is the standard bearer of atheism, in fact has set up a foundation of reason and science. But if there is no design or order, how can reality be intelligible to reason or scientific investigation? In this regard, it's interesting that Hawkins himself comments like this: the more we discover about the universe, the more we find that it is governed by rational law. If it is governed by rational law, it has a design. An acclaimed physicist called Kaku also says the universe could have been perverse, could have been random or capricious. And yet, he says, it appears to us to be whole, coherent, and beautiful. Incidentally, even the apparently startling fitness of mathematics to describe the laws of physics points to an internal logic in nature. Otherwise, you cannot calculate with it, you cannot produce equations. But the point is that there is not only a law and order in the universe, there is something also which is really quite extraordinary. It has been colorfully described or called the Goldilocks enigma by Paul Davis, who is a very famous astrophysicist, after Goldilocks and the three bears. In his book of the same name, Davis, a distinguished astrophysicist, recounts how in the 60s there was a young English cosmologist called Brandon Carter, who wrote a very simple paper. And he said, listen, you guys, suppose the laws were a bit different in this or that perspective. What happens? Well, what happens is there will be a total disaster. It seems that the universe is governed by constants of nature, which not only determine its structure and evolution, but were fine-tuned to the possibility of life and eventually us appearing on the stage. Any infinitesimal changes in these numbers or forces would render the cosmos as it is impossible. This really shocked the scientific community, and in fact, the controversy is still with us. I would love to give you a few examples, but just two, not to take too long. There is a number in the universe called Q, which represents the ratio of two fundamental energies, and it is 1/100,000 in value. If Q was a bit smaller or a bit larger, the universe would be inert and structureless. Another number called N, just imagine, equals 1 followed by 36 zeros. Now this number, if it had a few less zeros, we would have had a stunted universe with no time for biological evolution. There are some who imagine maybe up to the insect level. And staggeringly, this fine-tuning is evident even at the very earliest of creation. For example, Hawking claims that the ratio between the competing forces of expansion and gravitation could not have deviated by one part to the power of 60. And you'll agree that stretches our credulity a bit too far. In fact, after saying this, Freeman Dyson, who is a fellow of the Royal Society, came to this conclusion: I do not feel an alien in the universe. The more I examine the universe and study the details of its architecture, the more evidence I find that the universe, in some sense, must have known that we were coming. How interesting. So what is the message here? The message is, rather than the universe being a cold, brainless machinery, where man accidentally and oddly appears to be, the universe seems to be miraculously fine-tuned to the emergence of life and us. And this brings us to the crucial subject of evolution and life. And as you know, in 1859, Charles Darwin published his famous book on the origin of species by natural selection, which described how all life developed by chance mutation and selection. As you can imagine, this created quite a commotion in society and even in science. And over the years, evolution has become enshrined as an established explanation of biological change and the appearance of man. Now, it is vital to observe that by evolution, atheists mean that this process is blind, accidental, and purely material, without purpose and without design. In fact, to quote Dawkins in a very famous book, he says, "The only watchmaker in nature is the blind forces of physics. Natural selection, the blind, unconscious, automatic process which Darwin discovers and which we now know is the explanation of the existence and apparently," he says, "purposeful form of our life, has no purpose. It has no mind, no mind's eye. It does not plan for the future. It has no vision, no foresight, nor sight at all. If it can be said to play the role of a watchmaker in nature, it is that of a blind watchmaker." Now, incidentally, Dawkins here is mocking William Paley, who in the late 18th century, he was a Christian apologist, remarked that if he is on a walk on the moors and he finds a pocket watch, he assumes that there must have been a watchmaker. But is Dawkins, in spite of his rather flamboyance, correct? Many prominent scientists, in fact, have come round to the conclusion that pure Darwinism, or neo-Darwinism, is highly underdetermined. That means it just cannot carry the radical claims made on its behalf. Now, Dawkins himself can be quite ambiguous. I'm mentioning Dawkins repeatedly. because he has influenced hundreds of thousands of people throughout the world. I was surprised myself after what I have quoted. I was surprised to find him saying in his book, Climbing Mount Improbable, it is grindingly, creakily, crushingly obvious that if Darwinism were really a theory of chance, it couldn't work. You don't need to be a mathematician or a physicist, he says, to calculate that an eye or a hemoglobin molecule would take from here to infinity to self-assemble by sheer higgledy-piggledy luck. Wow, once again. What's going on here? Is evolution blind or not blind? And that's exactly what mathematicians have done. They have calculated probabilities and improbabilities. Life, as you know, operates with hundreds of thousands of proteins. They are the building blocks of life. And it has been calculated, just imagine this, that the odds against producing these by chance is more than 10 to the power of 40,000. In fact, the very famous Sir Fred Hoyle, a renowned mathematician astronomer, compared these odds against the spontaneous formation of life with the chance of a tornado sweeping through a junkyard and producing a Boeing 747 jet aircraft. Hoyle and a friend of his came to the conclusion, and this is very important, if the beginning of life, the beginnings of life were not random, they must therefore have been the product of purposeful intelligence. Discussing a phenomenon called resonance, never mind what it means in fact, the production of carbon. Hoyle, in his inimitable way, commented, a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as with chemistry and biology to produce such fine-tuning, and therefore there are no blind forces in nature worth talking about. And this is a very... if you please, this paper was written to the annual reviews of astronomy and astrophysics, so, you know, a very high-level publication. In fact, Hoyle is reputed to have said that nothing shook him out of his atheism more than this phenomenon. Now, there are other glitches in the theory of evolution, by the way, some minor and some grave. I will mention a couple because they are very interesting. You know, evolution depends on mutation and variation. However, it has been found that the capacity for variation in gene pools has been exaggerated and seems to be very self-limiting. For example, a bacterium called E. coli, which is found in the gut, after 30,000 generations, which will be equivalent to 1 million human years, there was not evolution, but devolution. And Michael Behe, an esteemed biochemist who furnished this example, concluded that there are radical limits on the efficiency and efficacy of random mutations. Now, I'm often surprised how people, scientists or not, forget that Darwinian evolution by mutations and natural selection can only operate where life already exists. It cannot explain the origin of life. And here I must state something very clearly. Nobody knows how the first life originated. Science fiction accounts, and we read a lot of them, of life arising from a primeval soup. Believe you me, it's just science fiction. For example, Stuart Kaufman, professor at Santa Fe Institute and researcher on the origin of life, says anyone who tells you that he or she knows how life started on Earth some 3.45 billion years, is either a fool or a knave. And Michael Denton, a very noted geneticist, remarks that the break between the living and the non-living world represents the most dramatic and fundamental of all the discontinuities of nature. And so we come to what has been dubbed the molecule of life, the DNA molecule. The discovery of DNA, you know, by James Watson and Francis Crick in 1953, and undoubtedly counts as one of the greatest scientific triumphs ever. The DNA looks like a ladder. Incidentally, Isu Garigor Maldi, like a ladder with a half twist. The sides, I'm not going to go into details, but I would like to show something. The sides, you see there are the sides and cross linkages. Now the sides are made up of what are called sugar phosphates, and the rungs of the ladder are made of bases, and there are four of them. They are called AGCT, adenine, guanine, tyrosine, and what did I leave out? Adenine. Thymine, guanine, cytosine. Now, it's interesting that this molecule, every three bases is a code of instruction. So you have a language of four letters. That's all you have. But every three denominates something. They are called codons. Now, the DNA can unzip down the middle and separate, and each half will induce the formation of its counterpart, because the bases, A, always combines with T, adenine with thymine, and G, always with C. However, so this is a self-replicating molecule, but the most important is that this molecule is also the database of the cells, written in a four-letter alphabet, AGCT. The information is coded in the type and precise sequences of the bases. Now, what happens is that this molecule, every three bases, give an instruction. Then there is a parallel molecule which takes it to the powerhouse of the cell, the industrial setup called ribosomes, which then actually manufacture the proteins concerned. Now, the reason why I'm saying this is that the DNA is in fact a codebook of information with 3.5 billion letters long and contains 7 billion bits of information. Now, as you notice, molecular biologists realize, and this is what I'm coming to, that the language and methods of information technology is necessary to interpret the genetic code. And believe me, any slip-up between one base from the thousands and thousands, any slip-up of one base being misread will result in catastrophe. So even here, at the basis of life, there is very fine tuning. And let me give you an example of a fine tuning here. Isaac Asimov, whom I used to read voraciously when I was without white hair, calculated that there are, imagine, 10 to the power of 190 possible ways of making a hemoglobin molecule which carries the oxygen. Which means there is a choice larger than all the particles in the whole observable universe. Now, that is stretching credulity and sheer chance too much. Now, I try to provide evidence and arguments, especially from science, because I think one can follow the how cogent is what I'm talking about. But remember that you have to take this on trust. Most scientists have been persuaded that purely random processes cannot account for the origin of complex information systems like life. It has been established. To put it bluntly, therefore, and this is what I am coming to, who provided the information in the first place? Because wherever there is information, there is an underlying intelligence. So the enduring mystery of modern biology, how did life start in the first place, reduces itself to the origin of the digital information encoded along the spine of the DNA. And I find this personally fascinating. That indicates intelligent design. And Stephen Mayer, who wrote a very landmark book called Signature in the Cell, states, intelligent design is an evidence-based scientific theory and does not appeal to biblical accounts. It is a scientific-based where the origin of information comes from. Talking about disinformation, I'll close this bit, then we rush. Life involves a complex DNA database of digital information. The only source we know of such language-like complexity is intelligence. And now, theoretical computer science indicates that unguided chance and necessity are incapable of producing language-like complexity. So obviously the answer is that we do not know. People who have faith, no. But from the scientific point of view, nobody can account for the original input of information. Incidentally, Francis Collins, who is a committed Christian and a prominent geneticist, was the leader of the Human Genome Group, involving over 2,000 scientists worldwide. Sequencing the DNA and identifying 30,000 to 40,000 genes, he exclaimed in rapture at the end of the project, which was about 2003. "It's a happy day for the world. It's humbling for me," he says, "and awe-inspiring to realize that we have caught the first glimpse of our own instruction book, previously known only to God," he says. And for those who still wonder whether science clashes with faith, here is what Collins says. "For me, the experience of sequencing the human genome and uncovering this most remarkable of all texts was both a stunning scientific achievement and an occasion of worship." And he goes on that his book, The Language of God, by the way, is intended to dispel the notion that a rigorous scientist could not also be a serious believer in a transcendent God, by arguing that belief in God can be an entirely rational choice and that the principles of faith are in fact complementary with the principles of science. Now, in May 2004, Anthony Flew, who was an international celebrity in philosophy, and who was, by the way, the torchbearer of atheism for 50 years, he attended a symposium in New York University, and he literally lobbed a thunderbolt. He declared that he now believes in God. When asked if recent work on the origin of life affected him, he said, "Yes, I now think it does, almost entirely because of the investigations of the DNA." Actually, I had two other reasons, which are not quoted here. One was why there is something and not nothing, and the other was that there is a regularity in the laws of nature. And now to my final section, because you're all tired. Now, science appears to consider man as just another body, like a rock or a star, to be studied exclusively by the methods of natural science. But is that all there is to man? And what do we observe about man that is essential for his identity? Man certainly is a part of nature and is driven to know more and more how the material universe functions. And that is good. But man is also driven to discover meaning in his encounter with reality, which is a broader experience. John Polkinghorne, a physicist, theologian, and fellow of the Royal Society, warns, "We have to accord enough attention to our subjective experiences of beauty and moral imperative as we do to our more objective encounter with the physical world." What do such things as history, literature, poetry, art, music, philosophy, religious experiences, existential anxieties, love, friendship, heroic sacrifices, and acts of solidarity, what do they attest to? What am I? Who am I? What is the meaning of life? Is there no good or evil, but the soulless grinding of a giant machinery? What is justice, pain, and suffering? Whence the yearning for meaning and immortality? What is happiness? And where lies the meaning of a tear on the face of a child? What is this deep sadness and longing and emptiness we all feel sometime or other? What is this black hole inside us, sometime so black and voracious that it leads to suicide? Whence the inexorable tug of conscience and the moral law within us? What is the source of confidence, certainty, unwavering dedication, and happy sacrifices in a Mother Teresa or a Saint Francis? Yes, we can truly say that if there is one phenomenon which is empirical and hence scientific, in the sense that it is definitely observable, it is this hunger of man for meaning, hope, and immortality. Perhaps that's why the writer of Hebrews writes, "Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen." The greatest threat to men, and I dare say his civilization, is to see him as an accidental offshoot of nature, where only nature exists. And here lies the crux of the so-called clash between science and religion. Religion does not clash with science, but with naturalism. That is a belief, and it is only a belief, that all that exists is the order of nature, and that man is merely and exclusively part of it, like a pebble or a reptile. No wonder Plato used to call him a biped with feathers. It is the reign of the jungle. According to Dawkins, the universe has no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing. In this grim view of the universe, without God, without a benevolent creator, nothing but matter and energy, how can one ultimately justify ethics, compassion, and dignity? The great Russian writer Fyodor Dostoevsky, agonizing over the rise of secular atheism, warned that without God, everything is possible, everything is permissible. And he was quite prophetic about what happened in his own country. The late Vaclav Havel, a secular Czech intellectual and writer, persecuted, as you know, under the communist regime, which espoused a purely materialistic conception of human life, argued that such a view leads inevitably to the gradual erosion of all moral standards, the breakdown of all criteria of decency, and the widespread destruction of confidence in the meaning of any such values as truth, adherence to principles, sincerity, altruism, dignity, and honor. And yet, the great Greek tragedian Sophocles, in his play Antigone, says, "There are many wonderful things in nature, but the most wonderful is man." But why? To answer with Pascal, the great mathematician turned religious philosopher, man is but a reed, but the most feeble thing in nature, but he is a thinking greed. Yes, indeed. Man thinks, feels, yearns, aspires to understanding, longs for a final meaning. That makes him in nature, but not completely of nature. Man is conscious, has an interiority, unique in nature. Now, let's not be hesitant and call it a soul. To be complete, man needs to be open both to aspects of his identity, open to science to understand more and more about the cosmos, open to the spiritual, which constantly wells and prods him. And yes, there is no conflict here. In fact, complementarity. If science has limits, other ways and means are not only justified, but necessary to answer the deepest queries of mankind. Remember, reason doesn't stop where science stops. Professor Lennox, who is an Oxford mathematician, put it this way. The point is that in cases where science is not our source of information, we cannot automatically assume that reason has stopped to function and evidence has ceased to be relative. On the other hand, Pascal put it in his own inimitable way. The heart has reason, which reason doesn't know about. So finally, the great Spanish philosopher Ortega y Gasset remarked in this respect, scientific truth is characterized by its exactness and certainty of its predictions. But these admirable qualities are contrived by science at the cost of remaining on the plane of secondary problems, leaving intact the ultimate and decisive questions. We are given no escape from ultimate questions. In one way or another, they are in us, whether we like it or not. And he says scientific truth is exact, but it is incomplete. And perhaps that's why Einstein used to say, science without religion is lame, religion without science is blind. Now, Anthony Flew, it's interesting, tellingly ascribes his conversion after 50 years of campaigning for atheism. He explains his conversion to a belief in God as a pilgrimage of reason. He used to say we must follow the argument wherever it leads. Socrates used to say that too. And he maintains that the world picture that has emerged from modern science points to God. John Lennox, which I quoted, in his book God and Stephen Hawking, puts the issue of science thus. Does science point towards God, away from God, or is it neutral on the subject? At the end of another of his books, called God's Undertaker, in conclusion, he says, I submit that far from science having buried God, not only do the results of science point towards his existence, but the scientific enterprise itself is validated by his existence. And that was the main theme of my presentation. Lastly, I promised in the beginning to answer those three questions. I did not forget them. One was, does the spectacle and workings of nature suggest the creator? The second question was, is the use of reason, including science, adequate to answer the first question? My answer to both is yes. The third question, is fate irrational? My answer is no. By the way, David Hume, the arch skeptic, himself said, it is rational to posit a creator in his book, Natural Religion. In fact, Einstein, with his usual penetrating gaze, wrote, everyone who is seriously engaged in the pursuit of science becomes convinced that the laws of nature manifest the existence of a spirit vastly superior to that of man. And so I ask you, ladies and gentlemen, as I ask myself, from the evidence, which is the greatest leap of faith, to believe that man is the chance offshoot of blind accidental forces, which we don't know where they came from, or to believe in a benevolent creator who created an ordered universe, friendly to life and the emergence of man, capable of a final encounter with the creator. For John Polkinghorne, outstanding physicist and theologian, there is no doubt. For me, the fundamental content of belief in God is that there is a mind and purpose behind the history of the universe, and that the one whose veiled presence is intimated in this way is worthy of worship and the only ground of hope. Thank you.
Prophet Mario, I think it was a fantastic presentation with lots of reflection and lots of wisdom. I'm sure there would be a number of comments and observations following Mario's presentation. Are there any comments or questions? Yes.
Hello. I recently read a book written by a geneticist on the whole issue of intelligent design a few months ago. And it, the geneticist said that he's discovered, and it's kind of becoming known in his field, that there's no positive mutations in living organisms. Generally, mutations are neutral or negative in all their findings. So that's the kind of skeleton of evolution, the kind of basis to the belief in evolution, is that there's positive mutations happening by chance. And he says, if you're a geneticist, you cannot believe that. It's impossible. There's adaptations in the genes, but the genes don't jump around unless it becomes something negative, not useful. He says, basically, a positive genetic mutations happening all the time is completely impossible. So therefore, this whole theory of evolution is really hard to describe from a genetics point of view. No, it's from a book by a geneticist.
You tend to agree with it, or you want to ask about it? Okay, Maria?
If I understood you correctly, what you're saying is that evolution, you have the positive and negative. Yeah. May I just clarify my point, or rather my position? Religion does not clash with evolution. It clashes with blind evolution. And apart from religion now, some of the points which I make indicate that there are some fine-tuning in development which are beyond the odds that reason would accept. But I personally think that there was a process of evolution, there is no doubt about it. However, evolution starts at the level that there is life. And one of the three great discontinuities of nature are from nothing to something, which I think is a very important point. The other one is the appearance of life, and science definitely doesn't know the origin of life. And the appearance of man. By man I mean intelligence. So one has to accept that there are these great discontinuities which have not been described by science, but I think genetic transmission is completely acceptable from the religious point of view, and as you say, sometimes it goes bad. But that brings us to another long story, why there should be evil in the world. We'll talk about it another time, perhaps. However, there is an argument, maybe this will appeal to you, that although nature has been created, there are some theologians who believe that nature has been given a certain autonomy. So if you get an earthquake, because of the internal dynamics of the place, the Creator may not intervene, because that's how it happens. It doesn't mean it cannot intervene, but it may not intervene, because that was the result of geological forces, for example, in an earthquake, which are also laws of nature. I hope I got your point.
Okay. A question?
Hello, thank you for your lecture. My question is, how can you measure spiritual life? I mean, there's no weight and width. And what's proof, except, I mean, we have the Lord Christ who presents all these magnificent signs that he did when he was on earth, on this earth. And you have said earlier on that, how would you know if there is good or evil? I always say that awareness, when you're aware of something, good or evil, but if there's no awareness, there's no good, neither evil. So awareness is the main thing that you could tell if good or evil exists. But when awareness is finished by death, right? What is left? How would you know, for instance, judgment, if there is no awareness anymore? Thank you.
Well, certainly, where I may not agree with you is that evil disappears on if you're not aware. But other people are aware. You're not the only person in the world. It has been calculated that the of the 100 billion neurons in the brain, including its connections of one brain, extend to a bit more than twice the circumference of the Earth at the equator, which is the widest, about 100,000 kilometers. So if you ask me, the origin of consciousness, it's absolutely a mystery. In fact, I was aware that the National Association of Neuroscientists in Germany, so, you know, there is a level of science, scientific research there, published actually a document a couple of years ago, not more than 2 years, where they stated that they have a consensus that there is no explanation of consciousness. These were neuroscientists. So,
more questions?
Has science an answer to the origins of the four fundamental forces of nature? Because, to my knowledge, they did not evolve, because they are not something biological. As you implied, evolution presupposes being, presupposes existence. Now, the forces of nature which brought about the evolution of the physical universe, their origin, does science have an answer for their origin?
That's a very important question, as you know. The four fundamental forces of nature, as you know, gravity, the strong and weak force, and electromagnetism. Now, the weak and the electromagnetic forces have actually been found to become one at the very, very earliest millions of seconds after creation, after the Big Bang. However, up to now, nobody has unified the other two forces. But you make a very important question, but why should they be like that? I agree. And you cannot tell that you understand, that is the point I made about the value of a scientific explanation. Even if they find eventually, that's what's going on, by the way, at CERN at the moment, going to the very earliest state of the universe and using the highest possible energies, because the four forces are assumed to become one at the very, very earliest moment. However, even if you find an explanation for this, as you say, Why should they be these? Why not others? And yet these have determined the evolution of the development of the universe, which has made it also, by fine-tuning, possible for the emergence of man. So it's a very important question, this.
Okay, can we have the last question, please? Okay.
Mario, as usual, first-class material. You reminded me, Mario, of something which I lived when I was about 6 years old. My father was, as usual, saying a story, telling me, you know, telling the story, I was in bed, etc. And he ended up with the usual, and they lived happily ever after. And I remember asking him, what is ever after? And I remember him smiling and saying, I don't know. And for many years, I used to think my father was not intelligent enough to know that answer. Then I grew up and I understood that he was wise enough to understand that he did not know the answer. I am very lucky that it was not Richard Dawkins who was saying that story. He would have ruined it all. But there are also people who do not believe, like Richard Dawkins, but unlike him, who almost hates God. Almost he is the proof that there is God because he hates him. There are also others, like, for example, Julian Barnes, who actually says this wonderful sentence which sometimes repeats itself in my mind. He says, I do not believe in God, but I miss him. In science, have you met people who, I mean, you meet people who, of course, do not believe in God, others who believe in God and prove that he is God. But did you meet people who actually do not believe in God, but missing him and trying to find him through science in your experience?
Thank you.
From the reading which I have done, which has been pretty extensive, I was surprised to learn that if you take a poll, roughly 45% of top rank scientists are believers, which an impression which we are not normally given to consider. And of course the great pioneers of the 20th century, of the major revolution in science, Schrödinger, Heisenberg, Planck himself, even Einstein. You know, somebody, I mentioned the belief which Einstein had, and somebody had remarked that Einstein believed in the God of Spinoza, not in our Christian sense, personal God. But actually it's not true, because I have found the letter which Einstein wrote to a close friend of his, and he told him, actually, I'm not an atheist, and I'm not a pantheist. If he's not an atheist and a pantheist, he's a theist, which means he was a believer in God, but he did not expound too much on the subject. But Lisa Rendall, who has just now published a book on what happened with the Higgs boson in July, Knocking on Heaven's Door is called, makes a comment actually, which echoes your point. She said, in order to practice as a scientist, I have to believe that the world is rational and it would lead us somewhere. So it's almost a religious comment.
Thank you, Mario. I feel that this evening we've had a different dimension of our discussion. But it is very clear that science and religion are not contrary to each other. The truth is one. The only difference is that science and religion address different aspects of the truth. I feel it is very important for one to appreciate this purposefulness of evolution. I like to quote Pierre-Théard de Chardin. And Pierre-Théard de Chardin used to say that evolution has direction, both forward and upwards. It means that as we go along, there is more complexity, and this complexity will increase consciousness. So we, as human beings, become more conscious. But it also has a movement upwards, towards God. And essentially, I think, the final analysis, the raison d'etre of this evolution is to bring man to God, which means that the spiritual dimension will increasingly become more important. I feel at this stage, one has to appreciate that the increased importance of spirituality will make us see truth in a fuller dimension. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin argues that the moment that humanity realizes the power of love, life will change. But I also tend to argue that humanity is the raison d'etre of all creation. Without humanity, this appreciation of creation couldn't have happened. There is this appreciation because we exist. So there was a purpose for this creation. And as you argue, there were given conditions for this existence to happen. So there definitely is a design, there definitely is a purpose, there's definitely an intelligence which has made life possible. So thank you very much, Mario. That was a fantastic evening.